Hi, I'm Dave Emery. This is For the Record, program number 1031, interview number one with Jim DiEugenio, author of Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on November 13th of the year 2018. It is my pleasure and my privilege to bring to our airwaves and to introduce to our audience Jim DiEugenio, the author of a number of books about the assassinations, the JFK assassination in particular. In this case, Destiny Betrayed. There is a new edition of that book that is out, and it could be described, I think, as a triumphal treatment not only of Kennedy's assassination, but of Jim Garrison, New Orleans District Attorney's District Attorney Jim Garrison's investigation into same. Jim, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you very much, Dave. Glad to be here.
We are hearing a lot of things in our media about fake news, about lying. I noted with a degree of bitter amusement about a week, maybe two ago, Paul Krugman of the New York Times, in an op-ed piece, was writing about how when he first began writing for the New York Times, which published the Warren Report, he was forbidden from using the word lie. And I thought that was grotesquely ironic for America's, quote, paper of record, unquote, to forbid him to use the word lie when they published the Warren Report, which is a lie. And we're hearing about fake news. Many columnists are talking about Donald Trump and the Republicans and intoning about how our democracy is imperiled. Well, I would submit that our democracy had its brains blown all over the back of a limousine in Dallas, Texas, on November 22nd, 1963. And I think at this point in time, plus we are now in November, which is an anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination, I think this is an appropriate time to do a deep dive into your magnificent work. One of the things that I think is most important about Destiny Betrayed is how you illustrate how our media, the press, the Fourth Estate, has functioned in this case with the JFK assassination. A much more recent example would be the destruction of Gary Webb and his coverage of the Contra cocaine trafficking. You illustrate how the Fourth Estate has morphed into a fifth column. Instead of telling us the truth, our media, in the case of the JFK assassination and so many other things, functioned as an extension of the national security establishment, and they functioned quite, elements of them functioned quite consciously to obfuscate the truth and engage in some frankly criminal wrongdoing in that regard. The narrative that you present so compellingly, I think, might be begun by talking about JFK and his political outlook, something we have spoken of on this program as how one of the major features of the Cold War was the failure of the U.S. to adhere to a promise that had been made, which was that the colonial properties of the various European allies would be given their freedom at the end of World War II. In fact, the U.S. retrenched on that and sided with its European allies in attempting to preserve the pre-war colonial status quo. And when the attempts at retaining the antebellum colonial status quo merged with the Cold War, the stage was set for some not only extremely violent and bloody goings on. But ultimately, for the conflict which would result in JFK's assassination, you point out very compellingly that whereas JFK has been represented by a number of so-called progressive media as a reactionary and this, that, and the other thing, in fact, he was a political visionary of sorts, at least in the context of his time. As someone who was in the baby boom or baby boomer generation, the Vietnam War was arguably the central political element in generating the political consciousness of this generation. Certainly, that war was a major event in all of the lives of the people that are in this generation. And, of course, it grew out of France's attempts at retaining its Indochinese colonies. And you talk about JFK being many years ahead of the curve on Vietnam. Why don't we start, Jim, by having you relate what he did in his early 1950s trip to what was then French Indochina.
Well, that trip in 1951 was designed to get him more up to speed, because he had been a congressman at that time, and congressmen are usually more concerned with domestic issues. And so it was designed to get him up to speed so he could run against Henry Cabot Lodge the next year for the Senate. And so he took two trips, one to Europe, one to the Middle East and the Far East. When he flew into Saigon, he deliberately kind of shocked the French emissaries that were sent there to escort him around. Because at that time, of course, France is involved in this let's call it a colonial war, from 1946 to 1954 to recolonize Indochina. And so, but young Kennedy, I think he was 34 years old at the time, you know, wanted to get some more objective people to talk to about, you know, are we backing the right horse here? Because even at that time, the United States was paying a lot of money to finance the French war to retake Indochina, and it just got worse and worse, 52, 53, and 54. And so he ends up knocking on these various reporters' doors, like Seymour Topping of the New York Times, and he ends up talking to a guy he knew previously, a guy named Edmund Gullion. Edmund Gullion had been a State Department official who Kennedy had met, I think, in 1947, because he needed some information about a speech he was going to give in Congress, right? So Gullion had been transferred to Vietnam because he spoke fluent French, you know, and he had been there a couple of years already before Kennedy got there. So Kennedy looks him up, and they have dinner at this, if I remember correctly, it was like a rooftop restaurant. And so Kennedy asks him, because, well, is we're backing France. Is France going to win the war? And Gullion is very frank, and he says, France is never going to win the war. And so, and Kennedy asks, well, how come? Because Ho Chi Minh has fired up this Viet Minh militia to the point that these guys would rather die than go back under the yoke of colonialism. And with those as the stakes, France could never win a war of attrition. They would literally have to wipe out every single one of them, and that is not going to happen. But beyond that, this thing is going to get so bloody that the home front will rebel against the effort. And so this had, according to Robert Kennedy, this had a really deep impact on JFK's thinking, you know. And because it ended up being correct. All right, and of course you can attach that to the American experience in Vietnam also. Same thing happened. All right, so JFK, after that meeting, it's really kind of remarkable because he begins to make these speeches and to write to these letters to his constituents, these radio addresses, and he begins to attack this whole viewpoint about this supposed battle between communism and America and democracy in the third world. And he says, he cuts right to the quick. He goes, look, this is not about communism. This is about the desire of these people to be free from colonialism. And we have to find a third way. We have to find a way to go ahead and grant them their independence and at the same time try and channel them into a peaceful, democratic kind of society. And we should be able to do that. You know, he kind of said, you know, we shouldn't be afraid to compete with the Soviets in the third world. We can give these countries more aid. We can help them to independence. We don't have to fight the desire of these countries to be free from colonialism. And we should not, just because a country is an ally of ours in Europe, we should not side with them automatically in this battle in the third world. France is wrong to try and do this, you know, because they're not going to win the war, and because the Vietnamese will not give up until they have the promise of freedom when it's all over. Kennedy made these things. See, this is something that I have to say this, you know, when I first discovered this, which was, I think, in about the late 90s. It was by accident. It was a pure accident. I walked into some bookstore, okay, in this little town called Julian near San Diego, okay, and I saw this book there sitting on a shelf called JFK Ordeal in Africa. And I picked it up because I had never seen it before. And there was a picture of Kennedy getting the news of Patrice Lumumba's death. And he has this terrible, pained look on his face. So I said, boy, I've never seen that picture. And I've never read this book. Maybe I should take it home. And so I did, and it was like the light went off in my head because, and this is the way I feel about this, David, today, the way I feel about this subject, about Kennedy's foreign policy before he became president. Okay. The circumstances surrounding Kennedy's assassination, we all know there's been a huge cover-up of that all down through the years. But I believe that the cover-up about who Kennedy really was and what his foreign policy really was, that goes even deeper.
Amen. very quickly, Jim, a piece of Vietnamese history that has gotten eclipsed as well. Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh were actually military allies of the U.S. in World War II. What had been French Indochina was conquered and occupied by the Japanese. And Ho Chi Minh and his guerrilla force received aid from the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS. And he was expecting the U.S. to fulfill the unofficial promises that were made to him that the Vietnamese would be given their independence. And that also, I recall as a young man, or really a kid, being force-fed, or spoon-fed would be a better word, the view that the Vietnamese were just, you know, yellow-skinned, slant-eyed agents of the communist peril, blah, blah, blah. In fact, Vietnam had a long, centuries-long history of independence struggle against the Chinese. So this is some of the deep background to what you have been detailing for us. Go ahead, Jim. Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. The real cover-up, but the deeper political cover-up with regard to Kennedy's assassination is the assassination of Kennedy's political persona itself, and Vietnam is a key part of it. Go ahead.
See, now, so once you understand that, once you understand that background, okay, it's much easier to understand why Kennedy did what he did once he got into the White House. He was determined that what happened to France was not going to happen to the United States. So that's why when everybody was trying to convince him to go ahead and save the day and commit American combat troops into Vietnam, he absolutely refused every single time. The very first year in 1961, there were 8 attempts to try and get him to commit combat troops into Vietnam. He turned them all down. Then in November of 1961, there was a 2-week debate that went on in the White House over this issue. Okay? Again, JFK refused to do it when almost every single other person in the room was urging him to do that. And in fact, there's been new declassified notes on this, which say, which I didn't know before, President Kennedy brought his brother into the Oval Office for that debate. And he sort of like, it was sort of like a tag team. You know, Bobby Kennedy would keep on saying, "We're not committing combat troops." Somebody else would request it. "We're not committing combat troops." And then JFK would back him up, and he said, "The only way we're going to do this is if we get a multilateral force to go in there with us," knowing, of course, that that was never going to happen. Nobody was going to try and get into Vietnam with this war raging.
A coalition of the willing, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. All right. So that's why he did what he did at that time. And then, of course, we know that in 1962, early 1962, he had told John Kenneth Galbraith to go to Vietnam and give him a report because he knew, of course, that Galbraith was on his side. And so Galbraith filed this report, you know, and said, "We have to start separating ourselves from this regime because they don't have the allegiance of the people." All right? And so what happened is that when Galbraith came into Washington, Kennedy told him, "Bring your report to Robert McNamara and tell him I told you to do so." And so in April of 1962, Galbraith met with McNamara, gave him his report, and McNamara now became the point man on Kennedy's withdrawal plan to get out of Vietnam. All right? And that raised a big ruckus, but McNamara stood by it. And then in May of 1963, another very strong piece of evidence on this, McNamara has a meeting in Hawaii of all the high personnel in Saigon, CIA, State Department, okay, the Pentagon, et cetera. He brings them into Hawaii, and he says, "I want everybody at this meeting to produce a withdrawal schedule of everybody you have and how you're going to get him out of here, and I want it to be as fast as we can." Well, he gets the schedules, and you know what he does? He says, "This is too slow. We have to get out faster." All right? And that piece of evidence was classified. I don't think they did classify until 1997. So it was classified for 35 years. We didn't know about that meeting. And it's the best evidence we have that Kennedy really was getting out of Vietnam at the time of his death.
It is grotesque, I think, that, well, maybe I'm being overly harsh, but the so-called progressive sector continues to cling to their, frankly, mythological interpretation of Kennedy as a reactionary and a cold warrior, whereas, in fact, he was, for his time, something of a political visionary. And the Vietnam imbroglio, the war, the changes in it, are a subject we will take up at greater length in the future interview when we talk about how Kennedy's assassination changed Vietnam policy. And again, Kennedy had, to recap what Jim has and to synopsize what Jim has presented so effectively in Destiny Betrayed, Kennedy from the early 50s on was aware of the fact that Vietnam was not so much a manifestation of the Cold War as it was of the anti-colonial sentiment on the part of countries that had been colonized by some of America's European allies during World War II. And that informed his thinking and his policy decisions throughout the course of his congressional and senatorial career, and also when he became president. French Indochina, Jim, also embraced the country that is now known as Laos. And bearing in mind that the median age in this country is something like 37 or 38, so most people were not even born when Kennedy was killed. If you would develop for us what was going on in Laos, again, another part of what had been French Indochina, what was going on in the country of Laos during the Eisenhower administration, and how Kennedy once again was going against the national security grain, to coin a term, with regard to Laos and what he did.
Well, it's interesting because the last meeting that Eisenhower had with Kennedy during the interval between when Kennedy was elected and inaugurated, Eisenhower tried to tell him that Laos is a very, very serious problem. You had this leftist group called the Pathet Lao, all right, and then you had the royal family, which of course was the establishment, institution controlling the country, and the Pathet Lao were making a lot of progress, all right? And it was only a matter of time until they took over the country. And Eisenhower did not want that to happen, and he told them, that's the place where you might have to go ahead and insert combat troops right off the bat. Now, Dave, let me ask you a question that I think everybody should be asking themselves. What on earth difference would it have made to the security of the United States if Laos had fallen to the Pathet Lao? What? Were they going to, launch an invasion of America from across the Pacific Ocean?
Well,
Kennedy didn't understand that kind of thinking. Kennedy thought that there were certain places in the world that were very sensitive to our national security, like Berlin. Okay, he thought that was that's a place that, we cannot let the communists take over there because it could roll up the whole European alliance. Okay, but he just said to Nixon, look, I just don't see why we should commit American blood and treasure to a place like Laos. And so he told Averell Harriman, who was in his Far East division, that, look, I have no intention of going to war over Laos. Okay, so, we can go ahead and make a show of force there. We can bring in, the Navy off the coast, or near the coast, but I'm not going to commit combat troops to this place. I just don't see why we should do that. So I want you to go ahead, and I want you to negotiate a kind of neutralization treaty there. Okay, and so he sent Harriman over to go ahead and do that. I think it was in Geneva. And then that is what he got there, that there would be a kind of neutralist government there in which there would be participation of all sides, and that held for about a year or so until Johnson started escalating, this war in Indochina. See, when Kennedy passed away, he had certain restrictions on what the military and the CIA could do in what we call these cross-border operations into Laos and Cambodia. Those restrictions were very much changed, okay, once the White House was occupied by his successor. And this is how the air war began over for Cambodia and Laos. And later on, Nixon was even worse than Johnson. He invaded both countries, you know, and we know what happened as a result of that. Okay, it was just terrible, a terrible miscalculation, you know, of geopolitical importance. And that's exactly what I mean. See, Canada didn't see the importance of this. You know, why should we commit all this money, blood and treasure, to these countries that pose no security risk to our own safety?
Absolutely.
You know, see, Johnson and Nixon were dyed in the wool Cold Wars. And I like what you said earlier about, see, Kennedy was caught in this kind of cold warrior vibes, which really didn't fit him. But he had to serve, like every president, you got to do it lip service. You understand what I'm saying? So you have to make some, to protect your right flank, okay? Mm-hmm. So you have to say some of these things. But the important thing is what he was doing. That's what you have to keep your eye on the ball about. Okay, because what he's doing does not match many times what he's saying. Okay, and that's the important thing.
Yep. Jim, before we leave the subject of Laos, we might want to mention what the CIA was doing there with the Hmong tribesmen, which later achieved a higher profile in journalistic and political scientific annals in this country in connection with what Alfred McCoy termed the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia.
Well, that, of course, was a very secret story, you know, that didn't come out until over a decade later, because the CIA couldn't get the royal family to put up an army to fight the Pathet Lao. So they eventually turned to these tribesmen that you mentioned, these Hmong tribesmen, and there had to be a way to supply them with a kind of black budget, okay? And so what happened, of course, is that they began to go ahead and use the poppy plant that goes in there through the Golden Triangle and transported through the CIA's Air Force, Air America, all right? And that is what they used. They began this heroin trade that went to, I think it went from Southeast Asia to Marseille, France, and then into the streets of New York, okay? And it ended up being terrifically, terrifically effective and very profitable. And the CIA was completely complicit in it. As you mentioned, there was a very good book on this by an American scholar, Alfred McCoy, all right, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, which is kind of a classic, all right, in that subject. And sometimes they would actually, I'm sure you know this, sometimes they would actually put the stuff in the body bags. They sent these dead soldiers back in order to transport it.
Absolutely.
In the United States.
Yeah. Again, there is a series in the anti-fascist archive shows available on the website about not only the CIA and the drug traffic, but the first one, AFA number 24, deals with this at some length. The point that I want to emphasize before we move to other third world countries that were struggling to shed off the colonial yoke, and that this in turn was cast into the fires of the Cold War, to mix a metaphor, is that the CIA and in Vietnam and in Laos had ongoing very deep covert operations. So not only was Kennedy working against a very powerful Cold War inertia and the economic powerhouse of what has come to be known as the military-industrial complex. But in turn, he was doing something that he later did in perhaps an even more lethal fashion in Cuba. We'll get to that either in this or our next interviews. He was cutting across an ongoing covert operation establishment in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of Asia, another country that, and the most populous Muslim nation, a major oil-producing nation, and one that was also a colony, this one of the Netherlands, was Indonesia. And once again, Kennedy's outlook on Indonesia and his decisions vis-a-vis policy there ran counter to the Eisenhower inertia and to the wishes of just about everybody else. You detail how Kennedy and Sukarno and the forces pulling in several directions played out. I wonder if you would develop that for us.
Indonesia is this giant island archipelago, all right, in the Pacific that had struggled to break free from its Dutch colonizers, all right? And it was led by a guy named Ahmed Sukarno, all right, who, when Muhammad Atta was his assistant, was a Muslim, because there was a large Muslim population there. And they led the struggle, and by about 1949, all right, much of the Indonesian archipelago was set free, all right? And see, the thing is, Sukarno wanted to be a very inclusive leader, all right? And so he tolerated a rather large communist party, about, I think about 25% of the population, the voting population, was a member of something called the PKI, all right? And John Foster Dulles, who was the Secretary of State under Eisenhower, and his brother Alan, who was the director of the CIA, those two guys did not like what they called the non-aligned movement. Now, what do I mean by the non-aligned movement? See, people like Sukarno, people like Nehru in India, all right, did not like what the United States had done in Guatemala and in the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, okay? And they did not like the fact that it was either you're with us or against us, which is what John Foster Dulles essentially said. You know, there can be no neutralism in the third world. You have to be on our side.
Very much like George W. Bush not too long ago.
Yes, yes. And I should say a third leader who was like this is Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt. You know, Dulles wanted him to lead something called the Baghdad Pact, which was going to be the equivalent of like CETO or NATO in the Middle East. And Nasser said, if I do that, my people are going to see me as a sellout. I'm telling them that I'm an independent leader. I'm doing best what's for Egypt. Okay, I can't join this thing. All right, and so the Dulles brothers essentially put him on there. Well, there's another guy we're going to have to do something about. All right, so these guys got together, Nehru, Sukarno, and Nasser, and they put together something called the Non-Aligned Conference. And Sukarno hosted it in the city of Bandung in Indonesia. I think it was in 1955 or 1956. Okay, and Dulles went spastic about this. And so the CIA then hatched a plot to overthrow Sukarno. And I think it was in 1958 that they went ahead and tried to overthrow him. All right, and it failed. okay, the plots failed, all right? And it was later exposed because one of the pilots flying the planes was an American, a guy named Pope, all right, because they downed his plane and he took him prisoner. And Sukarno said, the CIA is behind this. Look at this guy. He's an American. What's he doing flying one of these planes? All right? And so this really, really made Sukarno really against any American influence, you know, in his country. All right? And so when Kennedy comes to power, he has a whole different look at this. All right? And he says, I want to see, by the way, this really happened. I'm not making this up. He tells Alan Dulles, I want to see the report on the attempted overthrow of Sukarno. Dulles gave him a redacted copy. Now, Dave, when I get a redacted copy or you get a redacted copy, that's understandable. But the President of the United States getting a redacted copy? That's how these guys think.
Well, I think it is very significant, Jim, because it is indicative of the status quo of American power structure, where Alan Dulles, head of CIA, and John Foster Dulles, who was State Department, and previously both had been attorneys with Sullivan and Cromwell, which is inextricably linked with the growth of American corporate power on the one hand and American foreign policy, some might say intervention, on the other. So when Kennedy is being told, you know, go away, son, you bother me, in effect.
right.
It is, I think, very indicative of what Kennedy was working against, and beyond that, looking to our future talks and what you developed so skillfully in your book, what ultimately took Kennedy's life.
Yeah, I agree with that. So Kennedy gets the report, and even though it's redacted, he can see what happened, and he told somebody else in the room, he goes, no wonder Sukarno doesn't like us. We tried to overthrow his government. So he goes, well, let's make amends for this. So this is what he does. He wants to get Pope back, the pilot, all right? So he has Sukarno come into Washington, and he makes a deal with him. He goes, okay, you give us the pilot back. We're going to help you get this island called West Irion, which the Dutch had held out on this. So they knew Sukarno wanted this part of this archipelago of West Irion, but they held out against it, and they held out against it because they knew something that neither Sukarno or JFK knew, that there was tremendous deposits of silver, gold, and oil. They had done a geological test prior to this, all right? Incredibly wealthy. You're talking literally, I'm not exaggerating at all, you're talking tens of billions of dollars in those kind of raw materials that were on that island, all right? But Kennedy is intent. And so he has Ellsworth Bunker, a very experienced diplomat, and his brother, Robert Kennedy, ramrod a deal through that Sukarno will get this West Irion back, okay? And the Dutch were very upset about this, you know. Kennedy essentially railroaded us on this thing, you know, but he makes them give it back. So in other words, here's another instance where Kennedy is going against a European ally and siding with the colonial power. We saw it happen with the French, okay, in Vietnam, and now we're seeing it again in Indonesia. All right. And so he managed to go ahead and give it back to Sukarno. And Sukarno is overjoyed about this. He's now considered John Kennedy like his best friend. All right. And so what happens is that he invites Kennedy to come to Jakarta, and Kennedy accepts, and he's scheduled for 1964. He was going to be the first president. And Sukarno was actually building a mansion for him. just for him when he arrived there. And let me add one more thing about this, the whole Indonesia thing, before we go to Congo, is that Sukarno wanted to nationalize a lot of the industries that the Europeans and Americans had built in Indonesia, because it was such an incredibly wealthy country. And Kennedy actually helped him do this. He sent a trade representative over because he didn't think Sukarno was getting good enough deals. You know, because it would be like, say, the Europeans or the Americans will get 75%, and Sukarno and the Indonesians will get 25%. And he didn't like that. So he said, I think it should be more like 60-40 in Indonesia's favor. Okay? But so in addition to getting the governments angry at him now, now he's getting these businesses angry at him because he's making them fork over money. All right? But that's how intent he was on trying to give these formerly colonized areas a fair shake. And, of course, we can get to what happened after, yeah, because what happened after was an absolutely horrendous, you know, bloodbath, okay, after Kennedy's assassination.
Observers and analysts have noted that when Sukarno was overthrown in 65, in a CIA instigated coup, perhaps as many as a million people were killed, more or less right off the bat, and death squad rule, to coin a term, was then implemented. A point, Jim, about Indonesia: not only was Sukarno looking to nationalize major corporate interests, something that ran afoul not only of the colonial masters and corporate luminaries in other parts of the world, but something that was completely antithetical to the Dulles point of view and the Sullivan and Cromwell point of view as well. It is something that we will come into in a big way, either at the tail end or in our next interview vis-a-vis Cuba. But Sukarno was non-aligned, yet he was on friendly terms with the large Indonesian Communist Party, and that was absolutely anathema to the Dulleses.
Right, correct.
You made an allusion to the Congo, and again, bearing in mind that the median age in this country is something like 37 or 38 years of age, many Americans are not familiar with Congo. They're not familiar with Patrice Lumumba or the secession of Katanga Province or the would-be secession and the events that took place there and how Kennedy saw these things and the policy stances that he took vis-a-vis these individuals and events. Develop that for us, if you would, Jim.
All right. This is an utterly fascinating subject that I think gets too much ignored when we talk about the Kennedy administration. See, Congo had been a colony of another European country, namely Belgium. And there's horror stories about what King Leopold did in Congo in order to subjugate the native population and promote the colonial imperialism that essentially sacked the country of its natural resources and shipped them back to Belgium, leaving the natives pretty much in a state of landless poverty. And this was even too much for some of the other European countries, you know, who, you know, we know that great book that Joseph Conrad wrote.
Heart of Darkness.
Yeah, Heart of Darkness, which was based upon, you know, the brutality of the Belgians in Congo. All right. And so finally it got so bad that the Dutch Parliament decided to take it away from Leopold and administer it themselves. Well, what happened is that there began to be an independence movement in Congo. in the late 1950s. And one of its leaders was this dynamic young speaker named Patrice Lumumba. And Lumumba, and actually, and this is what makes this, I believe, so tragic. Belgian eventually saw that it would be wiser to make like we're leaving than to fight this guy, all right, than get involved in a civil war, all right? So there was elections held. Lumumba won the election to become prime minister. There was actually a constitutional government set up. But the Belgians had decided that they were going to sneak their way around this. And by rapidly withdrawing but leaving enough forces in the country, caused the country to collapse and then use the pandemonium that would ensue as an excuse to come back into the country. And I don't have to tell you, that's exactly what happened. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And they actually withdrew all their gold reserves, which should have been belonging to Congo, and they transferred them back to Belgium, you know, before they left. Well, what happens in just a matter of very few weeks, all right, the Belgians begin to provoke a kind of series of skirmishes. But even before they left, they had arranged for the richest regions in the country, Katanga, to break away from Congo and become its own state and being a sort of lackey state to Belgium, because that is where most of the natural resources, diamonds, cobalt, petroleum, etc., were located, all right? And that would have completely crippled any hope that Congo could go ahead and develop its own economy, all right? So the country goes into a chaotic situation. The Belgians come back in. They send paratroopers in. And Lumumba is looking for anybody to help him to get them out, all right? And so he goes to the United States. Of course, Eisenhower and Allen Dulles have, like, absolutely no interest in helping him, all right? He goes to the Russians, and that ends up being a mistake, because when the Russians start supplying him with truckloads of supplies and weapons, that's the excuse the CIA uses to say that he's a communist. So finally he goes to the United Nations, and Dag Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General at that time, does agree to do whatever he can to help, all right? But the UN is very slow in getting there. All right, but they do eventually send in about 18,000 to 20,000 troops of a multinational force. All right, but the CIA is intent on doing everything they can to go ahead and get rid of Lumumba. All right, and so they have, and by the way, the declassified documents on this are utterly fascinating. The way they built Lumumba into some kind of terrible communist force when he was neither a communist nor was he a terrible tyrant at all. He just wanted to have his country free and independent so he could govern it.
This is why
a series of plots, and I'm not exaggerating when I say this, there were at least four murder plots sanctioned by the CIA, maybe five, to get rid of this guy. And let me give you what I think is the most important thing. They were all timed to get rid of him before Kennedy was inaugurated.
Amen.
Yeah. All right. Because they didn't want to take – because Kennedy had actually, in his campaign to become president, He mentioned Africa 479 times during that campaign.
Jim, this is a point I want to underscore because it goes fundamentally against the grain, not only of what our mainstream media have spoken about, but again, the so-called progressive sector, which casts Kennedy as, you know, a rich white reactionary, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, he was something of a visionary and was able to see what were basically anti-colonial struggles and a dynamic that had been fully at work at the end of World War II and that the U.S. reneged on. He was able to see that in a different context from Cold War commie versus capitalist, and in this regard was cutting across fundamentally the political ideology and beyond that the economic ethic of John Foster Dulles, Allen Dulles, and the interests that they both represented and the interests that they controlled. Yes, the timing of Lumumba's death and Kennedy, if you would restate that and develop that for us.
Well, see, when Eisenhower went ahead and sanctioned the assassination of Lumumba, Dulles went ahead and gave the order. This was in the fall of 1963. But what had happened is that the UN, under a guy named Dayal, had decided to protect Lumumba by putting him under house arrest. So the CIA had to penetrate that house arrest, and they were frantic about it. They thought of so many ways of doing it. They thought of putting poison in his toothpaste. They thought of going ahead and sending a gunman in at night, okay? Probably this QJ Wynn guy, all right, who they hired as a paid assassin, all right? And there were a number of ways. They gave the station chief in Leopoldville at that time, it was called, a guy named Devlin. They gave him a $100,000 budget to get rid of Lumumba, which would be about $900,000 today. All right? $900,000 to get rid of this guy, you know, who poses no threat to American security at all. All right? And so finally, what they did is they said, you know something? I think we're going about this wrong. Let's cooperate with the Belgians and let them do it. Okay, and so what they did is they arranged to allow Lumumba to escape one night, and then the CIA cut off all of his escape routes to get back to his political base, which was Stanleyville. The Belgians picked him up. They gave him to the Katangis, all right, who were trying to break away, and they shipped him to Katanga. And a Belgian firing squad went ahead and killed him, and this was 3 days before Kennedy was inaugurated. 72 hours. They just made it. All right? But that's not but the actual details. This is how determined they were to get rid of him, to erase him from history. They then went ahead and they dug up his body. They poured it into a pail of sulfuric acid. When the sulfuric acid ran out, they set his corpse on fire. Now, is that about the craziest thing you ever heard of? All right.
Well, they did not want a body around, I suspect, to be used for a monument, a grave or a memorial that could then serve as something of an iconic rallying point for those who agreed with his points of view.
Right, I agree.
Another thing, we may not have time to complete this discussion in this program. We can continue that in our next interview and then transition to another struggle that is part of both the anti-colonial dynamic that occurred throughout much of the 20th century, but that also featured and still features in a big way in American foreign policy, that is Cuba, a struggle that is iconic in the political left was the Algerian War of Independence. Algeria was a Northern African or Middle Eastern colony of France. The Battle of Algiers is a well-known documentary. And it is, again, as I said, something of an iconic struggle for many people on the political left. And again, Kennedy has been tarred by those same interests as, you know, a reactionary, a cold warrior, a rich white guy who didn't understand wonderful people like us kind of stuff. And yet Kennedy, as we have been demonstrating, was keenly aware of the anti-colonialist desires and efforts and how they had been miscast in the Cold War dynamic. Algeria was another area where Kennedy's approach, I think, might be accurately termed visionary. Develop that for us, if you would, Jim.
Well, this is a really important subject. The whole struggle of the French colony in North Africa, Algeria, to be set free from Paris. And it began around 1954. And as you've noted, there's a wonderful film about this by Pontecorvo called The Battle of Algiers. And the French had a horrible time trying to put down this rebellion. And because of that, the fighting devolved into terrorism and horrible atrocities and torture, all right? And so when Kennedy decides in 1957 that somebody has to do something about this, because we're sending aid to the French in this terrible struggle, he makes what is probably the most famous speech of his senatorial and congressional career. In the summer of 1957, he rises in the Senate, and he essentially blasts, you know, John Foster Dulles, Eisenhower, and Vice President Nixon for backing France in its attempt to stop Algeria from breaking free of colonialism. And I got to say, this speech, if you haven't read this speech, you really should. You can look it up online to find it. And it's really hard to believe that a guy, an American senator, because you got to remember, back then, a lot of the Senate was dominated by this Southern Bloc, that they were supposed to be Democrats, but they were really more like Republicans, you know, like sure. Sam Ervin and Strom Thurmond and Richard Russell, et cetera.
Sure.
You know, and they were very conservative in their foreign policy outlook. And I forgot Lyndon Johnson, of course.
John Sherman Cooper, a member of the Warren Commission.
Yes, and Johnson was the majority leader.
Yep.
So when Kennedy, who is, by the way, in his first term, he's a first-term senator, when he steps up to the podium and he starts lobbing these hand grenades at the White House, this attracts a lot of attention, and most of it is negative.
Jim, we're almost out of time here. Let's pause here and tell people where they can not only get Destiny Betrayed, but other books and about your website and so forth. And let's begin our next interview with Kennedy's verbal and ideological hand grenades and the reaction to this speech on the Senate floor. You have a website, Kennedy's and King. Tell us about that.
Right. KennedysandKing.com is the website that I'm the editor of, and you'll find a lot of interesting stuff there about these cases, not just the JFK case, but RFK, King, and Malcolm X. And it's a combination of news and research articles, right, that you can, and book reviews. And you can get links to both of my recent books, Destiny Betrayed and the JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. You can click through if you want to buy those, okay?
Excellent.
Thanks.
I want
to get that plug in.
I want to put in another plug, which is the holiday gift season, gift-giving season is upon us. Often people ask me, well, I believe what you're saying, but I don't know what to do. There is a limit to what anyone can do, but something people can do is buy these books, buy Destiny Betrayed, read them, and give them as a gift of information and knowledge to other people. You also appear on Black Op Radio, Jim. Tell us about that.
Yes, yes. That's a show out of Vancouver, Canada, in which I'm a kind of semi-regular on that. And what I do there is there's a lot of listeners who want to ask me questions, and so they send them in to the website, Len's website, Len O'Shea, he's the host, or my website, and I take a lot of time to answer, because, yeah, I mean, you probably understand this. There's a lot of things to this day that people don't understand about the Kennedy assassination.
So I
take the time to answer those.
Great. Let's cut it off at this point because we are over time. That is something else people can do. Let us continue with Algeria and Kennedy's actions upon it and viewpoint in our next interview. This concludes For the Record program number 1031. Interview number one with Jim DiGiamio, author of Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on November 13th of the year 2018. For Jim DiGiamio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.